And so you'd be sitting, you'd be standing like this, waiting for the teacher to come in. And we're taught to have the thumbs inward, fingers together like this. So it's like having a wish fulfilling jewel inside. And then they drove the bats. They'd come up and go, and they do like this, they do like this, and then they do it, and they go, there was lots of stuff like that. And if you kneeled in a certain way, they would correct you. But the most interesting thing I found was that I needed my stick, because in Vietnamese Buddhism, you're up and down the wall. They kept trying to steal my stick. I'd be sitting there with my stick, and I'd be, and the stick was going like this, and they were, because they don't have sticks and compass. So what I'm saying is, it's not who's right and who's wrong, but there is this variety. It's a wide variety, you know. So if this doesn't suit, there is a variety that will suit. So really what you're looking at is the difference between worship, respect, trust. Faith will play a high part in all forms of Tibetan Buddhism, but it doesn't mean the same as it does from a Judeo-Christian point of view, and I will be going through that later. Okay, it's got nothing to do with blind faith at all. Okay, so faith is highly valued in all forms, apart from secular Buddhism. They have faith, but I'll come to that. Okay, faith doesn't mean the same. So what you're looking at here, all of these different types, you're looking for inner transformation. That really is what it's about, inner transformation. And that inner transformation comes to fulfillment when you start to develop personal insight. So for that to happen, you need to have high trust in the teachings. You have to say, do I trust these teachings? And when I was learning, another word for faith was trust. Mm. So it was the way the translation came very early. You know, they understood Judeo-Christian stuff. But really, it errs more on the side of trusting. Once you have the trust, once you start that personal journey, that inner journey, which gives you personal insight, then what you're looking at is you're really on the journey then. You're really on the Mahayana path. You're really on the journey in Buddhism. I think that's doing. In that journey, as you walk that path, what are you doing? Well, you're doing a lot of things. Faith is useful. But this comes a time when it will be of no use to you. Right? So faith will turn into wisdom. If you've got wisdom, you don't need the faith. What would you need the faith for? But at the moment, we're not sure. We don't understand everything. There are people who know more than us. Hard for us to admit, but true. But faith you will drop when the wisdom grows. Does that make sense? So that's what you start to look. So on that journey, the faith turns into wisdom. The other thing that happens is the confidence you have in the dark, the confidence will turn into certainty. It will turn into certainty. That's when you know you're making some progress. All of that will accumulate and it will culminate in liberation. Definitely. So I wanted to say that because otherwise, I mean, there's the story of the Buddha in the boat. Do you remember that one? There are certain things that we hold on to when we need it. And that includes everything in life, including Dharma. And the Buddha said, you know, if you're crossing a river, you need the boat. When you get to the other side of the river, do you carry that boat with you? No, you do not. So like that. Okay. I want to say quickly, although I'm going to be teaching a weekend on this in May, I want to say something quickly about meditation. And the reason I'm doing it now is when we start doing these topics, I'll want you to include two types of meditation. And I'll lead you in it, no worries. One is analytical meditation. Analytical meditation. Now, in many schools of Buddhism, they don't recognize analytical meditation. They recognize single-pointed concentration, sometimes called shamatha, you know, this type of thing, the ability to focus on an object for as long as you wish, that ability to really calm and steady the mind. In Tibetan Buddhism, they really value analytical meditation. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama often says that really, when you're starting out, analytical is often far more useful to you the single point of concentration. They do two different things. Analytical meditation is like an internal study, a quiet internal study. You're using your understanding, you're using your wisdom, you're using your creativity to do what? To move the mind from a misknowing of one particular topic towards knowing the truth ignored about that particular topic. So analytical meditation moves the mind. It moves the mind away from misknowing something towards being more, you know, actually knowing something that's true about that topic. It moves the mind. But analytical meditation really changes the mind. Analytical meditation, left alone, it will do some good stuff. But if you really want it to work, once the mind is moved and you come to a positive conclusion, you let go of the analysis and you hold that conclusion or that positivity that your mind's come to for as long as you can without wavering. And so the wise people have analytical meditation, single pointed concentration within the same meditation. Now, some people don't teach it like that. I teach it like that because that's what, personally, that's what works. You see, everything we learn here in the West, and it's not just the West, modernity is very wide now. It covers the whole world. But everything is, you learn this, and on the basis of that, you learn that, and on the basis of that, you learn that. Yes, that's what we do. We build up. What's the Buddha Dharma asking us to do? Is look at what you've built up. Really, look at what you've built up. And often, you need to deconstruct that and then reconstruct with wisdom. And that's what analytical meditation, it moves the mind. And the ability to focus on a conclusion or a positivity at the end of your meditation will change the mind. Okay, so I'll talk you through that. We'll talk you through that. Okay, so if you could look at this, the handout I put on the desk. Presenting the path to Lam Rim. The reason I've done it like this, really, is that everything in the Lam Rim was taught by Guru Shakyamuni, but it was handed down through two different lineages. And that's kind of, there's a lot of history which you can study for yourself, but this part is important. So there was what was called the Wisdom Profound Path. And that, you could see Buddha, Manjushri, Nagarjuna, and Tisha. Okay? So, then you had the method path. This was going on at the same time. That was taught by Buddha, Maitreya, Asanga. Both had wisdom, both had methods, but the emphasis was slightly different. In the wisdom path, there was much more effort in that path related to wisdom. In the method, the vast path, there was more emphasis on the vastness of methodologies. Okay, wisdom was in there, but it just wasn't as highly emphasized as it was. When Atisha went to Tibet, and he was asked by Jangchurpo, you can read about the history of that, but when he eventually went to Tibet, and he was asked to have a look around and see, there was a lot of error at the time. And what he did is he merged the wisdom method and the method path. He merged them both, because each one had values, and each one had a little bit of difficulty in a certain bit that the other method counteracted. So by putting it together, the whole path was corrected. And of course, when he was asked, really, could you develop something, some sort of teaching that has all the main points of Buddha Dharma, that would lead people through sutra and tantra, and that's when he developed Lamp on the Path to Enlightenment. And initially, it was really only a few pages long. Really, initially. And now you can get loads of books on it. Yes, a lot of commentaries. So that's why I've done it like that, just to remind you about that, because that's, you see, Lam Rim is taught in all schools of Buddhism. However, it's not the extensive way of teaching it is within the Gompa school, this school. The Lam Song Kappa school. It really is It is talking other skills and it's taught well, very good stuff, but it's not as extensive as it. The reason it's extensive is because when Lama Tsongkhapa, 14th, 15th century, when he was considering what was going on, at that time the different schools were abound. There was very little differences in the methodology aspects, but there were differences in the wisdom aspect. There were differences. And he was looking at how do I, you know, which path do I take for this? And he was advised, it's said, by Buddha Manjushri to rely on Atisha's teachings. When Atisha died, after a few years, this combined methodology fell into disuse and it was split up again. So in Lama Tsongkhapa brought it together again, the Atisha's teachings. Also, he was led by Buddha Manjushri and has said, you know, which aspect of emptiness, the wisdom, is the correct one? When it's said that the Buddha Manjushri said, rely on Chandrakirti, rely on Chandrakirti, rely on Nagarjuna. Why am I telling you this? You can read this because you will not find much disagreement in any of the methodologies in all forms of Tibetan Buddhism. But you will find some differences in the wisdom aspect. You will find some differences. Now, it is said, mostly by the Prasangika Majjhimika, is the Prasangika Majjhimika is the most profound. His Holiness says that, so I'm quite happy to say that. It really is the most, other some schools think it's the most extreme, but we tend to use the word profound. Okay, so I'm saying that without going into too much, because you need to know that if you go to a different school, you will learn not just a wee bit of different methodologies, but it'll mean the same thing. But when it comes to wisdom, there will be a difference. So my advice, if you're just starting out or you're not too sure, is choose one school. Learn their aspect of wisdom, right? And when you're sure of that, then with confidence, you can look at other ways of looking at wisdom. Where people fall down is where they go with this bit, and then they go here and get upset or worried because this is the point that we're saying. Then they go this, do you see what I'm saying? It is much better, choose whatever school you like, this is not a problem. But when it comes to wisdom, it's better to stick to one school, learn it well. Then you can look at the others and see how well it fits in. Especially if you develop your epistemology. Is that okay? Okay. So going down this sheet, it says three scopes. So in the scopes there, you can add in something like beginningless mind, eight worldly concerns. That could be entered into the initial scope. In where it says karma and developing renunciation, you can add in the four noble truths there. Okay? So it's just a different way of doing it. So because the Lamrim is so extensive, in the Galupa school, there are many commentaries, many, many commentaries. So here are some of the commentaries. So there's the great exposition of the stages of the path, huge. Middling exposition of the stages of the path, that comes in about four volumes. And then there's three principal aspects of the path, which is about thought. I must bring it in, it's quite a short. My advice is always start with the short one. So I think that's something that I wanted to say about that. So to finish off these scopes, because it's presented linearly, you may think, well, I have to do this first and this first and this first. No. No. I mean, it's helpful when you're learning. But in reality, it's all organic and it feeds back on itself. So method and wisdom, wisdom of emptiness, okay? It's there in the first. It's in the first scope. It's enhanced in the second scope. Losses in the third scope. So when you think you've learned about emptiness, please remember context. Everything in Dharma is contextual. So always, where is that? What context are you telling me this in? Like that. So that's important. The other thing to remember is each one of these topics, each one of these topics within this structure is worthy itself of weeks of study and practice, weeks of meditation. I mean, really. I mean, within our school, you could say, if you're doing, say, refuge, we do weekends on refuge, and it's a long weekend, just on refuge. You could do, I ran a retreat in Sweden, and we did death. One of the happiest retreats I've ever done. It was all about death. And we did about 7 days. So the thing, reason I'm telling you this, each of these topics is worthy of deep, deep study and meditation. However, what I'm going to do is I'll do my best. But remember, there's always room for enhancing. That's all I wanted to say. So I wanted to say this about Buddha Dharma. Really, what this path is leading to really is ask, if you follow this, is ask, it will lead you to liberation or full enlightenment. To do that, it does require a change in worldviews. How we see the world is going to, you know, change. So the best way to start this is to acknowledge, just acknowledge if you can, that there is an alternative response that we can make to life's everyday dramas, right? It's there. We just need to acknowledge that to start with. There is an alternative response to everyday dramas. It is not set in court. I don't care how many people agree with you. So first of all, we recognize that. Then you say to yourself, okay, if I do this, can I have the courage to abandon that which is negative and adopt that which is positive within this worldview? Am I going to give it a go? That's really what you're looking at. Can I develop positive Dharma habits? So these are the questions you're asking yourself. Why? Because if you follow the Lamrim, if you follow not the Buddha Dharma, not only does it you know, give you a different response to everyday dharmas, but it's a revolution of the mind. It really is. It's a revolution of the mind. What it does is it reframes everything. It reframes everything you're experiencing. And it reframes everything you will experience. It doesn't put it down, it doesn't ignore it, but it does reframe it.
Just a question, maybe sure. It's appropriate for a later part of the course, which is just now, I'll come on to
okay.
That.
No worries.
My question is just about thinking about the wisdom of emptiness. How does that link, in your opinion, with concepts of instinctive mind? You know, you get these philosophical, or you get these theories in psychology about attachment theory and how as human beings.
I don't know anything about the psychology. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't. But it, will it have relation? It will be related to it in some way. Mm. But it will be related to it in some way, but I won't teach that. Because to be honest, I'm not bright enough. I haven't studied that. I haven't studied it. It does relate in some ways, but the Dharma is something way beyond that. It really is way beyond that.
Yeah.
Because most psychology, most counseling, most helpful, what would you call this type of thing? Self-help,
yeah.
Psychology, what would you call it?
Therapy.
Therapy, so most of it is aimed at one thing, making you feel better. Making you feel better and making you have a, and encouraging you to have a happy, healthy, fulfilling life. And there is nothing wrong with that. That is wonderful. The Dharma way of looking at things is, yes, that's wonderful, but we're aiming for liberation and enlightenment. And so when they talk about attachment, they're meaning something very, very specific. Just because the word is used in a self-help way, it's not the same.
Oh, no.
No, no, you know that. I know you know that. But this is what I'm saying. The aim is always a better life.
Mm.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Darwin's not doing that. Yes, you will get a better life because that'll happen.
Yeah.
But it's not the aim.
Yeah.
The aim is liberation and enlightenment.
I think that when I did some of the mindfulness courses, that I began to realise that the aim of mindfulness used within the context they were using, it was to make people feel happier. Whereas I come from a position of looking at mindfulness from, like you said, about using it to transform my mind, which is different.
Yeah, it's different. But it's a good question, because what we don't want to do is get confused with that. I sometimes wish I had, instead of going into nursing and teaching, I wish I had gone into a bit more of the psychology.
Yeah.
It seems to be, you know, very helpful to people. My use those nursing, so
yes.
What to do? I only have a short life. So I want to think of things like worldviews. And worldviews is a way of examining your life, right? It's highlighting your worldview. What is the effect? Now, if we could agree, there's many different bits, but you're looking here at a set of beliefs. Everybody's got a worldview, a kind of set of beliefs, the fundamental aspects of reality that you think are true. All of that would be influenced by perceptions, yeah? Everything that's going on around you. So sometimes we don't, it's very simple, but we don't tend to look, how did I get here? How did I get here with this set of ideas that I have? So, if, for instance, you're a non-theist, right? You're a non-theist, and you're brought up in a non-theist country or a non-theist family. Really, what you're looking at is what? You're not looking at a creator God. So a lot of your worldview is based on maybe chaos theory, the randomness of it, a kind of evolutionary over a long period of time. And this answers an awful lot of questions about who you are, why you're here, what's happening. If you come from a theist worldview, you know, maybe a Christian or whatever, but a theist worldview, there are common elements. The common elements, for instance, creator gods. And if your worldview holds a creator god in it, then it explains the world. It explains what? Basically, it seems to boil down to, what would Jesus do? Every question, why are you here? Because God put me here. What are you meant to do? I'm here to do this, this, and this to serve God. You know, how does your ethics, well, what would Jesus do? So I'm not saying this is wrong. I'm saying that's a worldview. Okay? Whatever worldview you hold on to, it's then permeated by your personal views that you've developed in your life, that's adjusted that worldview. So you grow up, and because of your situation, you've got these values and beliefs, and we use that to adapt whatever worldview you have. So just let's just reflect on this. So put yourself in a... a reflective state. Just breathing out any tension. Breathing in the brightness of the mind. Try to consider what you think your worldview is. You don't have to feedback on this. Just, what do you think your worldview is? What constitutes your worldview? Some sort of fundamental points, some beliefs. What about your personal views? Your personal worldview? Something that you infuse into your worldview? What you learned in this life that has become a kind of personal worldview? Ask yourself, is your worldview and your personal view, is it in sync or is it disconnected in some way? how do you consider this world works? What's my role in this world? And whatever you've come up with, what has shaped all of that? What shaped it? Because whatever did strongly affects how you live, maybe. In any worldview, there are seven questions you really want to consider. First of all, what is my prime reality? What's really real? What is the nature of this world around us? What is a human being and what's the purpose of humanity? And the question that drives almost every sentient being, what happens when we die? Is it possible to know absolute truth? Is there such a thing? How do we know what's right and how do we know what's wrong? What is the meaning of human history and who's in charge? And you can see if these questions are important, how do you think a theist would answer most of that? How do you think a non-theist, perhaps an atheist, would answer that? These are fundamental questions, but the answer is very different. For the last minute or two, how do you think a Buddhist would answer these questions? Thank you. So I'm hoping this is not just teaching you to suck eggs. Well, it's fit. I think if something is asking for it, something that's totally different to a worldview that we have, then we really need to explore what we really know about our worldview. Because we tend to behave and act in ways that are acceptable to people around us without really going into it. So, from a Buddhist worldview, all of these questions in relation to ourselves. We're here not, from a Buddhist point of view, it's not random. It's not the result of chaos. Within Buddhism, certainly, there's acknowledgement of different gods, but that's just different ways of being. They're not really better than anybody else, really. The Buddha, I mean, you just have to read the early Buddhism to see that. But you can say quite clearly that in Buddhism, there's no belief in a creator god. No belief in a creator god. The closest thing we have to a creative principle in Buddhism is karma. We do some stuff like that. So who we are, what our experience in life is all the result of our verbal, physical, and mental actions. We create the world we live in. So no creator god. Closest karma, what do we mean? Well, we mean that we create every situation around us. And our creations and our experience within that creation is due to the results of physical, mental, verbal actions on our part. It's a big step, eh? But if there's no creator god, right? If it's not random, what are you left with? The chief protagonist, us. Now, within the Buddha Dharma, there are things I've said to you that are taken as a given. But you don't take it as a given unless you believe it. You have to search it out. But beginningless mind is a given in Buddha Dharma. We study it because we're not used to it. But broadly speaking, and we'll be spending most of tomorrow simply on mind. Simply speaking, what you're looking at here is a flow of mental consciousness. And because of how dependent arising works, and we'll go into that too, one moment of mind gives rise to the next moment of mind, which gives rise to the next moment of mind. If that's the case, where did this moment of mind come from? This moment of mind. No. Where did that moment come from? Will you ever get a beginning? Not if you believe that one moment of mind gives rise to the next. And so one of the principles of mind is beginningless. Beginningless. Right? There was never a moment when there was no mind. There was a moment when there was no you.
Of course.
There's never a moment when there's no mind. If one moment of mind gives rise to the next, it is beginningless. What creates this moment? What does that do? Creates this moment. When does it end? No end. So here we have the idea that mind is not in the beginningless, it's endless. It's endless. Now that, with a whole load of other things going more deeply into it, you can see why reincarnation is taken as a gift. Taken as a gift. In Tibet, in India, China, this is not a problem. For us, difficult. Difficult. Why? Because no one ever sat me down and said, little Johnny, listen to me here. Everything has a beginning, a middle, and an end. There wasn't a time that somebody sat me down and told you that, but you believe it. We all do, right? It's the way we think. It's the way we think. And when someone says, yeah, but it's this moment, like, yeah, but where did that come from? I've had people, I mean, Mary's been in the class, and they said, yeah, but where did that come from? And I said, well, I've sat for minutes going like this, and the person's so fixed, no joking. It went on for minutes before she suddenly went, you could do this all day. I don't believe that. I said, well, neither you should. Why would you? Everything needs exploring. through analytical meditation, study, single quantum concentration, you start to see reality for what it is. So reincarnation beginning with mind is a given. Because of that, because of the nature of mind, within each mind, there is this potential to become enlightened. No one has to give you enlightenment. No one gives you liberation. They can teach you, they can show you the way, but it's there already. Your potential to do all of that is there. No one has to teach you how to be compassionate. No one has to teach you how to be loved, because your Buddha nature is compassion and love combined. It's there already, but it's on such a different level than what we. Let's take a definition of compassion. If I were to ask you to write a definition of compassion, or just write down, it could go into reads, and I bet it would all be slightly different, right? It would go on for a while. I've done this, I don't do it anymore. But I've done this exercise. In Dharma, compassion is not wanting others to suffer. Finish. If you were to write a sentence or two, you would be able to about love. You'd go on forever. And there would be differences. In Buddhism, love is wanting others to be happy. So when you get words that sound similar to how you use them, check it out. Check it out, because the context is different and often the definition is different. It really is about becoming a good teacher, isn't it? But having said that, it's such a huge change. You need to be careful with teachers you have. Get good teachers. If you're going to attach yourself to an organisation, check them out. And that includes FBMT, that includes anywhere. Don't just go because it has a label Buddhist one, for goodness sake. There's some very strange people out there. And that's coming from me, right? Very strange. So check it out. Check them all out. And including here, everything. You need to check out. Because what they're asking you to do is deconstruct what you think you know and then reconstruct. Sorry.
I've just got a question there.
Sure.
I just wanted to have your opinion really on this. Do you think, because you were talking before about the concept of creator God, that aside, separate from that, there can be a concept of divinity, as in like a being that possesses all positive qualities.
All positive qualities?
Yeah.
Apart from Buddha?
No.
Well, forget the label Buddha.
Okay.
Imagine would Buddha nature be the equivalent of like a the concept of divinity?
No.
Yeah.
But I do know people that think that that's true. But certainly not in Dharma. Not in Dharma. But like I say, that I know people that would argue that. But why give anything a label that when it's not that?
What's the difference? What would your opinion of the difference be?
External and internal. You're becoming your own healer. See, if the Buddha bled and go, you are enlightened. You are enlightened. He'd do it, wouldn't he? Can't. He can show you the way. He can show you errors, but you have to do it for yourself. So I think it's the difference between looking at this and going internal. However, there are some very clever people, right, that might argue me out of that. They wouldn't argue me out of it, but they might argue you out of it. Not to worry. All these questions are fun, aren't they? You don't need answers straight away. Intelligence is the question you ask, not the answer you give. Two. So, what we're looking at here is you've got the Lamrim for sure. Within the Lamrim, you have this first teaching of the Buddha, the first thing he taught. Okay, the Four Noble Truths. So, how about we look at that? what's the first thing to be understood about this? Okay. When the in within the Four Noble Truths, none of it is, it's not meant to be believed. It's, that's an easy word, isn't it? It's cheap. I don't know about you, but I think sometimes we use the word belief very cheaply. So none of this was dogma. None of it was really to be believed. What the Buddha really did when he was giving out the Four Noble Truths in his first teaching, he was revealing the human condition. He really was, that's what he was doing. He was revealing the human condition. He was basically saying, you're in bondage. I can show you the way to freedom. You're ignorant. I can show you the way to wisdom. You're unhappy. Let me show you what true happiness is. This is what this is about. And so what he started off with that one, and seeing that, the first noble truth, the truth of suffering. If I get time, I'll do a teaching on this. But for the moment, that suffering, it was not to be believed. The Buddha said, what you have to do is look at the life you've got and look at the life to come and fully understand this personal truth. Not to be believed, to be fully understood. And he started with suffering. And normally you wouldn't start with that. You'd start with something else. But he started with suffering because it's a human condition. It's where we are. The second noble truth. Okay, we're suffering, and there is a source of all this suffering called the origin of suffering. He didn't say believe it. He said, find it and abandon it. You're in control. Find out what the origin is. And when you find it, abandon it. The third noble truth, which is called the truth of the cessation of suffering, he's really taught all of this can stop. It can cease. So for goodness sake, realize that. Don't believe it. Realize it. And the fourth noble truth was the truth of the path leading to the cessation. He did not say, this is the way, believe me. He said, cultivate it. Cultivate it, walk it, test it. So the Four Noble Truths, right away, the Buddha is teaching cause and effect. Cause and effect is huge. It's all over. It's all over. So this noble truth of suffering is an effect, isn't it? What's the cause? The origin of suffering. The truth of the cessation of suffering, that's an effect, isn't it? What's the cause? The path leading. So straight away, cause and effect is coming right in here. And taking personal control is coming right away. And in the path, he talked about the Eightfold Path, and these are teachings can go on for weeks. But really, he talked about the Noble Eightfold Path, and it totally counteracts the ignoble attachment to the eight worldly darkness. Completely. Within that Eightfold Path, it has what's called the three essential qualities. It has wisdom, it has ethics, and it has concentration. And so, right understanding and right thought, the wisdom of the path. Right speech, right action, and right livelihood. That's the ethics. Right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. All of that is to do with samadhi, to do with concentration. The right effort, the right mindfulness, the right concentration. Take the word wisdom. It can be described as a lot of wisdom is seen as a mental factor. And I'll go into that. It's seen as a mental factor of what's called fine discrimination. Fine discrimination. Really flourish. The acquired mind is free of afflictive emotions. Now watch out for that word emotion, okay? Because not all the afflictions are emotional. Okay. Afflictive mental states is better. I've got a lot of teaching from Geshe Tashi on this a long time ago. And we talk about afflictive emotions and you'll read it in the book, but not all the afflictions are emotions. And so afflictive mental states are probably a better idea. And like I said before, without these, the mind of fine discrimination has a natural tendency to move towards wisdom. It has that natural. People are not stupid. People know what they're doing. I mean, if you let people flourish, their wisdom shines through. It's quite amazing. So this first half here is just introducing the concept or the idea of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. Not simple, but fairly straightforward. So wisdom being a mental factor of fine discrimination, what it does, it contradicts the way ignorance views an object. That's what wisdom does in Dharma. It contradicts the way ignorance views an object. That's it, that's its function. But to be able to trust that, you have to have valid reasoning behind it. Okay? In Tibetan Buddhism in particular, you're getting the idea that if they're very, very particular about definitions, about the words they use, very particular. They're also very keen on lists. We shall come to that. So the second half of this handout, I'm just making sure I'm not going off. I do have an idea from the target something. The second half of this comes from Geshe Tashi's, one of Geshe Tashi's settings book, and I think it's a really easy way to look at. These afflictive emotions, the afflictive mental states, they have one job, and that's to obscure reality. If someone says, what does this emotion do? What does this affliction do? Listen with great wisdom. Just reply to each one. It obscures reality. Here's your problem. Now, if you look at this diagram, now the diagram is laid out like this. And Geshe Tashi spent a lot of time saying, you know, that's not how it works in life. In life, in any given situation, karmic effects making different karma, that's happening all over, right? It's quite chaotic. However, to understand it, he laid it out like this. Your main problem with left-hand side ignorance, this is the root of all delusion, all problems, all suffering. What are we ignorant of? We're ignorant of the selflessness of persons and phenomena. So here we're talking about the nature of reality. We habituate ourselves and we're born with it. It is an innate ignorance. We're born that what we see around us, starting with ourselves, is that there's something more, something within us that's a permanent entity, unchanging, solid. Something within us that's inherently existent, exists in and of itself. And we see everyone else the same way. That something, we know you get old, we know you get wrinkled, we know you die, but we think there is something self-existent within us that is in and of itself. Doesn't require causes and conditions, it's permanent. Then we look at everything else around us, objects. And although we know how this is made, roughly, right? And although we know this has got different parts, still, there is somewhere in there a flask. It's over and above what you see. Over and above its parts, over and above its functions, over and above what we label. There is a flaskness about the flask. It has a self. Okay? Now imagine everything in this room. You see it the same way. Intellectually, we may not, but that's how we behave. Now imagine everything in London job, everything in the UK, everything in the world, what we say. We're saying that everything that we interact with, human beings and objects, we see it incorrectly. we see it incorrectly. And because we see it incorrectly, we behave with it incorrectly. And here's what happens. The selfless persons and phenomena, because we have that ignorance, that's what leads to the next one, afflictive emotions, mental states. What's the main ones? Attachment and aversion. So you take me, for instance. Somewhere in here, there is a Mary that is separate from my body, that is separate from my mind, that is separate from my body and mind together. There is a Maryness here, right? As soon as I feel that, without choice, I, not you, by the way, me, I, me, mine, right? No choice. And once that I is strong, what happens? Like magnets, that's mine, and that's mine, and that's my attachment. I like this, and I like that, and I want this, but no choice. And along with that comes, I don't want that, and I don't want that, and I don't want that. You are not me. Aversion arises. So the three poisons within Buddha Dharma is ignorance, attachment, and aversion, but it all stems from ignorance. If you have a mind full of attachment and aversion, you've also got things like greed, jealousy, confusion. You've got a lot of mental states that are not positive. But you may have mental states that are not too bad, like contaminated love. I call it sticky love. Sticky love. Very partial compassion. We're not nasty people. Of course not. So even what we consider positive will have something of an error in it. It has no choice. It's coming from ignorance. If you have a mind like that, then how do you behave with your body, speech, and mind? You behave in a way that's driven by these mental delusions, which comes from ignorance. So even though you do good stuff in this world, and we all do as much as we can, it will be tinged by ignorance. Can't help it. Can't help it. What's the result of all that? Well, you behave in ways that is out of sync with reality and you'll create karma. Positive karma, negative karma, neutral karma, of course. Now, if you could get away with, let's say, behaving badly to someone, right? And they got upset, they shout at you, you think about it, so you go back and apologize and you think that's a finish, right? If only. So what happens is that you have the karma happening there and then, but a copy of that goes onto the mind stream. Your actions are not lost. No action is lost. Whatever you think, say, or do, the mind reflects it. The mind is there. Now, as it's on the mind stream, if you find yourself in a similar situation again, it can trigger that karma to blossom and you find yourself in the same situation. You see? That's suffering continues.
No, so that's how you get like almost this habitual behavior.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And can that, like, if you've got, like, say, families where parents have, it can almost like create a passing on of their habits. Do you know what I mean?
Well, that's going on too.
Yeah.
That's going on too. So is genetics.
Yeah.
I mean, genetics is a lot of predispositions. So that's already going in there. But here we're really looking at mind, because even in reincarnation, sometimes you're drawn to families that you recognize. Not just people for who they are, but situations. Mm. Situations. Habits, interesting. You'll always, in extremis, when you're dead and in the bargain, if you know you're dead, let's hope you do, but if you don't, then you're in extremis, you're drawn to the familiar, even if the familiar is negative.
Yeah, that's what I was meaning, that it doesn't necessarily mean.
The time to learn is when you're not in extremis. It's hard enough to change this pattern, hard enough to change. But when to do it is when you're not in extremis. This is why people come to retreat centres, to get away from extremis. Giving yourself the opportunity to change. So this is how samsara, this wheel of suffering, birth, aging, sickness, death, birth, aging, sickness, death, this wheel that keeps going just keeps going. Something's driving that. What's driving that is karma and delusion. Karma and delusion is what keeps this thing spinning. Now, the way Geshe Dashi taught it was, I mean, I've been taught it in different ways from different people, but I really got this. When you decide, I want off this field, he said, imagine all of this, this ignorance of fixed karmic action, suffering. Imagine it's like a car. Imagine it's like a car. And the car is going along the road, and it's, you know, the suffering is going. There's one way you can tackle it immediately, right? If you take the wheels off that car, even if the engine's going, it's going nowhere, right? Mm-hmm. Now, he equated that to ethics. If you can't watch your karma, try to abandon the negative, increase the positive. It's a song like that. Really watch your ethics. You can take the wheels off this car, and that will stop you going any further. Mm. Now, the engine's still running. It wouldn't take much for somebody to give you a new set of wheels. But if you want to stop that and take a breath and start changing, take the wheels off the car. And that really is about ethics. Get into ethics. Because if you're into ethics, then you're not creating the negative karma to push more suffering. You'll still have negative karma in your mind, but you're not creating more. The engine is still running at this stage. And what Geshe Dashi said, if you turned off the ignition, that car goes nowhere, whether someone gives you a new set of wheels or not, right? This turning off the ignition is wisdom. Get the wisdom there. The wisdom is like the keys of the car. Now this takes us to the idea of ignorance. Within the Buddha Dharma, they talk about two types of ignorance. They talk about acquired ignorance. And the clue is in the name. It's the type of ignorance that you acquire because of others' beliefs about the culture you live in. Things like assuming our existence is solid, true, and permanent, everybody says yes. But think of other cultures where sacrificing 500 cows or goats every 5 years is a way to please the god and make you happy. And it's not just in the East. There are sets of belief here, acquired ignorance. I got a letter about 3 years ago from our council, and it was instructions on how to kill squirrels. Yes, because grey squirrels are, of course, a huge pest, and in Scotland in particular, there are, you know, we've got a few red squirrels left in the bay. And so it's actually against the law in Scotland to feed a squirrel. Now, if you do it in your own garden, there's nothing they can do. But do it outside, it's against the law. And so they were going to have a cull of grey squirrels. Now, do you think that's an acquired? Yeah, to me that's acquired ignorance. No, we're going to do that. They can't make you anyway. But what I'm saying is this acquired ignorance, cultural, everybody kind of agrees on it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people think of things like sacrificing animals, doing all this, but we do it in this country. This acquired ignorance is here. They're just amazing. I got this letter. And I could send away for a killing cage. Wasn't I lucky? So acquired ignorance. That's the easiest one to get rid of. Understand your ethics, see what's going on around you, and come to your conclusions. Study the Dharma, come to some conclusion. Now, innate ignorance, now there's the difficulty here. What innate ignorance is that's the type of ignorance that comes with you lifetime to lifetime. It's a kind of spontaneous, natural tendency to view things as solid, inherently existent, real, permanent, existing in and of itself, out of causality. That's an innate ignorance. We're born with it. We're born with that. We're born misknowing. the nature of reality. Another spontaneous one, and you can see this in children, very young children, very young. Did you do that? We did it. There's a spontaneous natural tendency to blame others. It seems to be, just seems to be spontaneous. It's like, you can get out of it, but it's there. From very, very young children, you can see it. Spontaneous. It's always somebody else's fault. And even if you recognize some of your fault, there is much worse. And then you get the feeling is, I have to think like that because I'm defending myself.
Yeah.
And if I don't think like that, then I can't defend myself. You're actually doing the opposite. Mm. This is ignorance masquerading as help. But ignorance is only one job. That's to obscure reality. You don't need ignorance to keep yourself safe. You don't need it. So, any questions? So, I mean, I know we've not got to too many topics yet, but this Four Noble Truths is very important. The structure should be becoming a bit clear here, a bit, hopefully.
You spoke a bit earlier about setting boundaries with oneself in the external environment.
Sure.
Whilst here, and it'd be wonderful if you could speak, just following on from your last comment about setting boundaries with others, but at the same time behaving in a way that's aligned with them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes sense. I'm just not clever enough. I have to think. You see, there's lots in the books about this, but I'm really more interested in what works for me. Right? What works for me is whatever situation you're in, you don't look for the right answer. You look for the compassionate answer. You don't do what's right, you do what's compassionate. When you meet any situation, you meet anybody else in that situation. The way is, I wonder how I can be the benefit to this person. And I'm not being funny, but it just changes the whole vista of the mind. And so when you meet someone, you're dying to tell them about you. You do listen, but not very much, you know, and there's this type of thing. But in any given situation, if your thought is, how can I be a benefit to you in particular, or how can I be a benefit in this situation? Then that's kind of like my only boundaries. But I think you could. I think psychology would help you better with this. It's a dharma answer, but it
no,
works.
It's a beautiful answer because I think we can still set boundaries with others. It's not about the setting the boundaries, because sometimes where we're seeing something in the world that needs to be challenged.
Oh yes, yes, that has to be done. It's Holiness is very clear about that. We're doing the 8 verses of thought transformation, and one of the verses, when I see beings of wicked nature, stressed by violent sins and afflictions, may I suffer the defeat and offer the victory to others. That's a verse. But what that's really, that's not saying make yourself a punchbag.
Mm.
Or, you know, this poor me idea. It's not like that. It's only this sense, you know, mostly, if you're in a situation where there's negative stuff happens, in some way, shape or form, you have contributed.
Mm.
Either in a past life or in this. You are not wholly pure in this. And when it comes, when it's dealing with you in particular, if it's true, recognize it, learn from any criticism. Don't say, well, that's, well, you're even worse than me, not like that. So learn. If it's not true, then it's just noise. It's just noise. However, he says, when you're viewing situations where other people are involved, then you have to stand up for it. You have to be their protector. You have to be their guide. You never let iniquities pass. Never.
Mm.
It's a mistake people make about Buddhism. They think it's very passive.
Mm.
It's not. You would always fight.
Yeah.
Always fight for others. When it's just yourself, then it depends how far along the path you are. Somebody shouts at you, tells you off, and you go, you're absolutely right. I really shouldn't have done that. she would take the human deal. Right. Well, you're quite right. We do that a couple of times. They've got nothing. They have got nothing. And somewhere in that situation, I have found over the years that some of the problem is definitely. Sometimes we don't set out to offend or hurt people, but something in what we said, the way we said it, or even, you know, you don't see someone, they think you're ignoring it. Somewhere along the line, there is a. And if that's happening, it's karma ripening. So somewhere in the past, you've contributed to that. So I have no problem with that. See, when it's me, that's not a problem. Okay. Sometimes I go away. You know, it depends how good I'm feeling that day. However, if it's for other people, you always stand up for them. Mm-hmm. You never let that go. You have to protect people. What's the point of being a bodhisattva or going that path if you can't even help someone with some trouble in front of you? What a nonsense. Anyway, right? Is that okay?
How do you know in that situation that that you actually assess the situation correctly? Like, you know, if you jump to someone's aid and then realise.
Well, here's your choice. You do nothing because you're not sure. Or you do your best.
Yeah.
And
your best, no, and your best will change with the more skill. I mean, for instance, if somebody comes to you and they've got a problem, if you've got counselling skills, then you can help more. There's someone that doesn't have counselling, well, it depends on the counselling, but anyway, the counselling skills, they can help more.
Yeah.
If you're bleeding, better to come to Sarah and me, because we have the skills that will maybe save your life. That'd be quite handy.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're there and nobody else is there, you do this. And the more, and if that means you then study and learn a bit of first aid or whatever. So the more you learn in the Dharma, the more you learn any of the caring professions. A good counsellor could be so much more helpful than a Dharma practitioner at that moment. Because if someone needs that type of help, they need to have it. How can you practice Dharma if you're unwell? This is the other thing I'd like to say is Dharma is interesting. Dharma really requires a kind of healthy mind. Now, that doesn't mean to say you don't have a bit of depression. That doesn't mean to say you don't have a bit of illness, right? But reasonably speaking, you need some sort of reasonable mind for Dharma. If your mind is too heavily one way or too heavily the other, then it's better to advise people to go for a walk.
Mm-hmm.
Go to the cinema. Go and pick flowers.
Mm-hmm.
Study this, study that. Sometimes that's better. But once the mind is calm enough, then Dharma can take hold.
Mm-hmm.
I said this once, and you're saying people who are ill can't have no. That's awesome.
And I think you also need to have quite a lot of strength as a person. Like when you talk about seeing things as they really are, like sometimes if people are going through really difficult circumstances, you might need a lot of strength to actually see this. We are, you know what I mean?
Yeah, if people are that's extremis.
Yeah.
Then the last thing they need is teaching them emptiness.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless they're a Dharma practitioner,
yeah.
Maybe they've forgotten. No, that happens. I mean, it doesn't matter how much you study the Dharma, life kicks you and hard. And sometimes the stronger you can cry, you can be upset. You can get depression. But if you've got a history of understanding Dharma, then you can maybe mention that to the person. But otherwise, no. You look at what they're saying. You look at how they're presenting to you and you give them what they need, not what you think they want. Sometimes I used to see this with dying patients. Patients who are dying. It's not the time to teach Dharma. It really isn't. It's not the time to introduce anything new. It's the time to listen, see what they need and give them what they need. Oh, nurse, I am dying. Oh, what do you think? I think I am. That seems reasonable. I think I'm going to meet my mother and father and my daughter. What are you going to answer to them? I think so too.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're going to do that. Why? Because it's more important that people have a calm mind when they're dying than you try and push some sort of truth on. Having said that, you will get people who will turn around and maybe say no. Just hearing the Dharma, hearing words of the Dharma, hearing a mantra, even if they don't know what it is, it's going to be beneficial. I can't do it. I worked at the Marsden for a long time, and they need to do is dive in a calm way. Whatever's in there. Any other questions so far?
So that would go back to you saying that the action that seems most compassionate is the right one.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Always. Yeah. It stops you up into what you're doing in this. What do you think? And the answer you give yourself may be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But you have no control on the result of your action. See, we think we do. We think we can control people, control events. If I just do this, and work hard, then this will happen. No. It could happen. The chances are it might happen, but you've no control. You've got little control. I have little control over my own life, but I have a running jump at it. The only person I can really control is here. So I do my best. You try and get yourself as much information, practice, meditate as much as possible, and you give your best. And your best 1 year will be the same as your best the next year. But people who are trying to, if I do that, then they will do this, and this will happen. Well, it's possible, but again, we think we have control on other people and events, and we do not. I don't care how hard you work, I don't care how clever you are, you don't control events. You've got little chance of controlling yourself unless you work at it. How much events? You can see abusive relationships like this. People try to control their workplace, they can't do it. So then they try and control their home and their family, they can't do it. So they choose one person there and they put that down. It's all to do with it. But it's energy sapping. You can't do it. In the end, you can't do it. But we all think we can. So you're not responsible for what other people do. You're not. You do your best. You're always coming from a compassionate attitude. Always doing your absolute best. But how they respond will be really, there's so many variables in how they respond. Too many of you. Not just in this lifetime, other lifetimes. That doesn't stop you doing what you need to do. What stops you is being attached to a result. Do not be attached to a result. It's fallacy. Pure fantasy.
So does that mean that you can't make somebody else happen?
No, you can't. You can set up circumstances where if certain things, you can certainly do things. I mean, this is not a recipe for doing nothing, because, well, we can't make people happy. No. I mean, you need to have all Maslow's hierarchy of needs met. And then they've got a chance. So you do as much as you can. But you can give money, you can give effort, you can give as much as you like, but they'll be happy. But it may be miserable. It may be, why didn't you do this last week? I needed it last week, you didn't bother. You just don't know. So being attached to any result, and people say, I'm not attached to any result. I give freely. I say, wait. This same person, when they give something, they still expect a thank you. And if that person then tells somebody else, is that what you do? Very happy. You're attached to none of it. So, this evening, if it's possible within the lab room, I'd like you, you can go over what I've said, look at your handouts, decide. One of the things that we're talking about really all day tomorrow, at least all day tomorrow, is mind. So if you want to read chapters in the books, to really give yourself a thought, is the mind the brain? Just think about it. Not yes or no, not like that. But ask yourself, what is the relation? Is there a relationship between brain and mind? Think about it. If there's not, fair enough. If there's a relationship, what is the relationship? There are many people who say mind is that which is created by the brain. Many people believe that. many people. Stephen Hawking once said, mind is that which is vomited up by the brain. So think about that. Think about mind, think about brain. And when I say brain, I also mean nervous system, right? I also mean mind. So thinking about where mind came from, where do you, I mean, just in your own case, just sitting quietly, strong motivation. Do I, never mind that, do I believe somewhere in here that the mind comes from the brain? Do I? Why do I believe that? Thank you. Where did it come from? It came from the brain at what point? Things like that. Start investigating that, because I want to spend all day tomorrow, at least all day tomorrow on that. It's crucial. It's absolutely crucial. So, we're going to end with a meditation. Oh no, it's 4:15, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ah, 4:15. Settle down.
Lord.
Okay. So we'll do it now then, if we have time. So just consider on your own just now. Ask yourself the question, is the mind, does it come from the brain, the nervous system? Do it come from my hips? Just where do you think? If you think the mind is same as the brain, fair enough. If it's not, then where did it come from? Just think. It's clear in this world that many, many people think mind is another word for brain. And you see it all the time, especially in the press. They'll talk about the mind, but what they really mean is the brain. And they talk about the brain and they include the mind. And people get a lot of their understanding about mind and brain from the press. So maybe consider this. The mind is dependent on the brain. This is a Buddhist view. The mind is dependent on the brain and the nervous system. It coexists. But the mind is not the brain. Mind is experience itself. If you have an MRI of the brain, it can show where an individual is thinking, even give you a broad description. It doesn't tell you what they think. In the Buddha Dharma point of view, mind did not come from your parents. One mind cannot be derived from another mind. And the mind cannot be derived from the physical body. Our present personality, our present knowledge and experience, if it's the result of our own past experience and actions, the mind is our own continuum. There's one moment of mind giving rise to the next. When we do mind, we'll look that all minds have a dominant condition and a causal condition. The dominant condition of a mind is the previous moment of mind. But to function in this world, it needs the brain and the nervous system. It's what makes it sentient. It can be difficult to prove intellectually, the Buddhist view, or even the scientific view. There's been no, according to the people I've looked at and the teachers I've had from Buddhists who are also scientists, there's nothing coming out of science that proves that the mind is the brain. What sustains the Buddhist view then? That the mind requires the brain in order to function as a sentient being? That it didn't derive from it. And this Buddhist view, this woman says, is sustained only by personal experience and by the experience of those meditators, those yogis, who have actually walked the path in 2,500 years. So we're going to be looking at this. And I want you to consider, if the Buddha Dharma is a journey from bondage to freedom, ignorance to wisdom, unhappiness to happiness, if that's the case, if this life is bondage, why is it bondage? The Buddha Dharma says, habit. The first habit we have that keeps us tied up in bondage is not understanding the suffering of ourselves and others. Not just blatant suffering, true suffering. We don't understand it. That keeps us in bondage. Because if there's no suffering, why would you walk the Eightfold Path? The regular suffering, in all its variations. The second reason we're still in bondage is because we believe suffering situations are actually happiness. We mislabel suffering as happiness. We're in certain situations and we label them happiness, and actually all it is suffering in a different way. The next reason we're still in bondage and we need to walk the path is we tend to see disturbing emotions, disturbing afflictions as somehow pure and permanent. That's me, not the idea. That's just who I am. You know? I'm just this type of person and that type of person. We seem to see that these things that we have, it's really one, as if they were permanent, as if they were pure. Well, that's just how I feel. I have a lot of people say that. Yeah, but I felt deep inside that that was the right thing to do. Based on what? Really? Based on a fleeting emotion that you like, that makes you feel good. Well. And the last habit we have that keeps us in bondage is this ignorance of self, others, or phenomena. We see that which has no self as having a self. We see ourself, others, no phenomena as having something within you that is inherently there, inherently exists in and of itself, solid, permanent. And the exact opposite is the truth. So that's something to think about. Just think about it. So now we still have time, so we can do some more. So now I'd like you to think about and jot down three things that you believe about the mind. Don't worry about it being right or wrong. Just mind. We all know we've got a mind, right? Although someone did once say to me, how do I know I've got a mind? Tricky.
That's insane. It's that whole argument that like consciousness is an illusion. Who's being deluded?
It's hard, but being, but you know, it was said in with sincerity. I mean, we weren't trying to be. So let's see. What if you, if someone to say said to you, tell me three things that you believe about the mind. Or when you think of mind, you think of these three things. Consider it. See, these are questions we never ask ourselves ever, really. Whatever you've written down, consider it tonight. If you would. You're not, I don't want you to feedback unless you want to. But tonight, if you're not sure what to do, meditate on that. Try and flesh it out. Try and take each bit and flesh out a bit. Buddha Dharma and all the meditations within it is grounded in understanding consciousness. Understanding its nature, understanding its function. All Buddha Dharma is grounded in really about the nature and function of mind, getting hold of that, because you can then transform destructive thoughts that harm ourselves and others if you understand its nature and function. Why are we going to spend a whole day on the mind? Well, His Holiness the Dalai Lama says there are two main reasons for studying the mind. One, mind and karma are intimately connected. Intimately connected, mind and karma. If there was no other reason, that would be enough. Mind is crucial in understanding happiness and unhappiness. It's crucial. My first teacher, Ramatukhi Nyeshi, said, I always keep it here. When we study Buddhism, we're actually studying ourselves. When we study Buddhism, we're studying our own minds. How to be healthy, how to be peaceful, with the emphasis on knowledge and wisdom, and never dogmatic views. Never. If our very existence here and our experiences has got nothing to do with the creative world, it's not random, it's not chaos, then there's not much left. You have to really start taking responsibility. We all have to. So what is it? It's us. It's our mental, physical, verbal interactions in the world. Buddhism often, Lama Yeshe used to say Buddhism wasn't a religion. He used to say that all. He says there's all trappings and it can be very helpful, very useful. And some of the, you know, the religious stuff, it's very, it can be very powerful in the mind. I don't dismiss it. I mean, it can be very. He says, really, it's the science of the mind. That's really what that is about. First and foremost, understanding that all sentient beings want to be happy, avoid suffering. All sentient beings, knowing the difference between samsaric happiness and genuine happiness, but really getting to grips, tasting samsaric happiness for what it is. It is unsatisfactory. It really is. It's temporary. It's limited. But above all, it's an illusion. If you want genuine happiness, then you need to know the mind. Because genuine lasting happiness has to be based upon a valid mind that understands the difference between existence and non-existence of an agent. We create a fantasy, we're going to the mind on top, we create a fantasy around every individual, every object, and then we believe 100% in the fantasy. And that starts us off with actions that create suffering. If we don't know that, what do? We grasp at any form of happiness. Anything that gives us that little lip, we'll grasp at it. And what we do is we grasp at it, then we exaggerate its effect. We then see that object as the nature of happiness. That makes me happy. And then you see that situation as having its nature of happiness. You don't, if you're looking for a partner, if you have a partner and you first meet them, what you first meet is someone and all the qualities that I've got. There's never been anyone kinder, more gentle, more humorous, so generous. I've met my soulmate. Not putting it down, it's just what we do. We take something and we exaggerate because that makes us happy. Exaggerate the whole thing. Put them on a pedestal because this will always give me happiness. After a while, how dare that person stop giving me happiness?
Mm-hmm.
Why have you stopped giving me happiness? All of illusion. All of illusion. Because we exaggerate. We're so thirsty for happiness. We'll take anything coming. It'll come, we feel a wee bit better. Then we'll do more of it and then exaggerate it. And this is not just a nice donut. This is the best donut I have ever had. This is the best donut I've ever had. It's absolutely fantastic. Really, yes. So what are you saying? That's the nature of happiness. Absolutely. Give me that five, eat six, and then tell me you're happy. You're not happy. You're miserable. How is that possible? If that has the nature of happiness, then the more you have, the more you'll be happy. Reasonable. But we don't ask these questions. We don't look at things in that way. And we keep making the same mistake time after time after time. We don't stop. Relationships. Next time, I'm going to find someone that at least is financially viable. So the person comes along, and that goes well for a while, right? It's exciting. Next time, I'm going to find someone that at least washes their clothes. Next time, I'm going to... So we keep doing it, and we keep thinking, I just need to change the external situation in some way, and then the happiness I get, I'll be able to keep it. I was really happy in the beginning, but Chico, he sucks his teeth. Or, you know, she's always, you know, she dresses like, you know, it doesn't matter, male or female, it doesn't matter. Eventually, it'll start to irritate because the fantasy that you've created around it, that starts to fall away, and then you're unhappy. How dare they make you unhappy? They're not making you unhappy. I don't care what they're doing, they're not making them happy. We make ourselves happy. Because we'll grasp at anything that makes life a little bit easier. And when we're unhappy, what do we do? Do we look at that unhappiness and go, oh, what? I mean, truly, why am I? When we're unhappy, do we? Yeah, we ignore it. Some people suppress it. Some people go in for distraction. Some people blame someone else. It's what we do. But we continue anyway. Everything like that ultimately fails. And unhappiness sticks to you like glue. If you're unhappy in the morning, chances you'll be unhappy in the afternoon and evening. Go to bed unhappy, chances you're waking up unhappy in mind. Breeds unhappy mind. One moment of mind gives rise to the next. Unless you do something, to see the reality of us. This habit needs to be skillfully dealt with. You need to come to grips with what the mind is, what thoughts are, and what you can do with them. And so here you can see that when Lama Yeshe said, and many other people say, you know, it's a science of the mind, it's real. And it's always said because the mind is crucial to your happiness and unhappiness. That's what it means. The mind is absolutely vital in relation to karma. That's what it means. In the different sciences, there's very little agreement about the nature and function of mind. We very rarely even think about a definition. I'm not saying we've got it right, but I'll run with this until something more reasonable comes. There seems to be more, I don't know if anybody reads the scientific papers, but there seems to be more interest in mindfulness things, more interest in consciousness. Interesting. But as some of my teachers I have that have done work in the sciences, they say, there's no money in it, maybe. There's no money in it. If you say you're interested in the mind, and you're interested in bare attention and developing consciousness, there's no money in it. Not only is there no money in it, you can actually be sidelined in all universities. They don't like it. Unless it's external, measurable, repeatable, observable, they're not key. The thing is, Buddhism likes all that.
Mm-hmm.
All that's good. It's just they don't see the mind like that. And because you can't measure, observe, and repeat something with the mind, they don't look at it. What they do is they look at the brain and the nervous system, and then they say, this is the mind.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the physicists tell. So, okay. But there is a lot more interest these days. Maybe that's enough. So are you happy with your evening? Would you be interested? Think about it now. Just think of me putting in another session one evening instead of you doing your own personal stuff. See, what I want you to do is your own personal stuff. That's good. Right? But, think about it, and I might put in it, if you're interested, put in an email. Just give you a bit of a break from trying to remember the study. So tomorrow will be on Zoom, and tomorrow I'm dedicated to mind. Now, is it everything about the mind? But what it is the basis. You have to get this in order to go further, right? Mine is extremely complicated. But this part that I'm doing is not so complicated. That's why I do it, right? I can manage this aspect. So I want to thank you very much for today. You're putting up with me and coming to the session. So the sandwich needs a good dedication. So if you could turn to the prayer book. They're very short prayers I'm doing. If you ever get teachings from Kaju Lama Zopa Rinpoche, these dedications can go on for hours. Anybody had teachings from Rinpoche? Hours. He thinks dedication is so important to changing the mind that he will spend a lot of time. So try to bring to mind the motivation that you have this morning. Hopefully Mahayana motivation. Between then and now, you've created a lot of positive karma. Just thinking about the Dharma, even willing to consider it, that's positive karma. But it can be lost. So what we do now is by dedicating you make it firm in your mind. If you can make it firm in your mind by dedicating it, then when it comes to fruition, in this lifetime or the next, it will be positive. So you could literally sit here, remembering the motivation and dedicating the energy towards achieving that type of dedication. And just sit with that for a minute. That's a dedication. Or you can do the prayers. The prayers are very helpful. So we'll do the prayers. Due to the merits, we'll do it together. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel Bodhicitta that has not arisen arise, and may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more. Thank you very much. Remembering that walking, seeing distances are very nice. But after your last session, see you on Zoom tomorrow.
Thank you.
For the next exciting chapter.